Welcome back, Question Medicine 2020. This is Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Another day, another dollar, another week, another podcast. You know the deal by now. We're going to get into what I'm getting on, and we're going to answer the question that is on everybody's mind. Whether you are knee-deep in COVID or you are just turning on the TV, you can't get away from COVID-19. So the question on everybody's mind is, when is this going to end? When will this be over? When can we go back to normal? Or what will be our new normal? Because I don't think we'll ever go back to a true normal as we previously knew it. So in this podcast, I am going to attempt to answer that very difficult question of when will this be over? So without any further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, here we go. Question Medicine 2020. Andrew Bilt, sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Let's do this thing. And as I said in the intro, I'm going to attempt to answer, when will this be over? This will be over, well, sometime in the future. When in the future? I'm not exactly sure, because I can't predict the future, and I don't pretend to predict the future. What will the future hold? I have no idea. Now, there are two ways to go about this. Sometimes, or some individuals, will just spew vomit from their mouth and say, well, I think that it's going to be over in 54 years. And then some people will use educated opinions to form their conclusion, and that is what I'm doing here, is I'm going to use educated opinions based on scientific fact to form an opinion of when this potentially could be over. There are multiple papers I will cite in the details of this podcast. All you do is scroll down, you hit details, in the details, it gives the links to those articles, but one of the big papers, one of the most interesting papers that I read and I think that everyone should really read is a paper titled Projecting the Transmission Dynamics of SARS-CoV-2 Through the Post-Pandemic Period. This was in Science, April 14th, 2020. And this paper does an excellent job using what we currently know and modeling computer statistics or modeling generation to formulate what possibly could happen going forward in the future. There is one thing absolutely clear. As we stand here right now, on May 2nd, 2020, there are currently no vaccines approved and no evidence-based therapeutics for SARS-CoV-2. Zero, zippo, zilcho, nunca, if you will. And I will grant you that this paper is a modeling-generated paper. And as we have seen from the modeling generated predictions of the death rate being 2 million down to 100,000, down to 75,000, down to whatever you want to do, whatever country you're looking at, the death rates have varied almost like my utility man, anywhere between 8 a.m. and 5 p.m. That is going to be the death rate. There'll be somewhere in between there. And you say to yourself, what do you mean anywhere in between that? That's terrible. And the problem is that modeling or modeling generated papers are only as good as the numbers you put into it. So if you have really bad numbers or really bad data, well, then you're going to get out really bad information. If you have good numbers or better numbers and better information, you will get better numbers out of it. The computer knows no different. It only knows the numbers that you put into it. However, this paper uses what I think are some pretty accurate and reliable numbers, and we're going to dive into those just a little bit. See, they take into account the contributions of seasonality, duration of immunity, and cross-protection imparted by prior coronavirus infections with the two other main coronaviruses that are in common circulation, HKU1 and OC43. Then they provide a variety of scenarios that could happen going forward. And before we dive into their analysis, let's just talk about these two coronaviruses, the two common circulating coronaviruses, HKU1 and OC43. You see, these two coronaviruses are in our circulation all the time. In fact, most estimations have them as being the second most common cause of the common cold, number one being influenza. If you go to the doctor and you're like, oh man, I have the cold, I don't know what to do. Well, it is probably either coronavirus or rhinovirus. It's one of those two viruses. If you don't have the influenza virus, then you probably, or a form of the influenza virus, then you probably have coronavirus or rhinovirus. And so depending on where you look, coronavirus has been with us for a very long time and is very high up on the totem pole as causing illness or causing the common cold. And it has a seasonal effect to it. It is mainly the winter months and it peaks around October, November, December, but it can be found on any months. It doesn't matter. It can be July, it can be June, it can be any time of month, you see. It just is more common during the winter months. The interesting thing about OC43 and HKU1 is that these coronaviruses are usually pretty mild. You have a little bit of the common cold, maybe some mild to moderate upper respiratory tract illness, but rarely, very rarely, do these coronaviruses kill you. Unfortunately, we have already seen with SARS-CoV-2 that it can kill you. And in fact, it's killing somewhere around 2 to 3% of individuals that are infected with it, which is a big number, but remember that still 97 to 98% of individuals that are living through it, getting past it, no problemo, and those are just the individuals that are testing. Remember in that New York paper for the pregnant women that came in, 15% of them had the coronavirus and didn't even know it. And if they hadn't came in to the doctor to deliver a baby, we probably would have never tested them because we didn't even know it. So the number is, death rate is probably much smaller, and the spread of the coronavirus is probably much wider than our numbers currently show. But I digress. Let's get back to the topic at hand here. What we want to know is the immunity for HKU1 and OC43. When you get these viruses, these coronaviruses that are in the same family as SARS-CoV-2, how long does your immunity last? You see, if you have immunity, you get the virus, it is relatively asymptomatic for you, you get it, then you developed antibodies that, let's say, last for your lifetime, then you would never have to worry about getting the coronavirus again, or at least really not getting any bad version of it again, because your own body's immune system would fight it off, and you hopefully would never, ever be affected by it. But luckily for us, they have done a study in Epidemiology, Infectious Disease Journal back in 1990. Yes, oh yes, we are going back almost 30 years, my friend. This is a time travel, if you will. And here we are in 1990, and this study, titled "The Time Course of Immune Response to Experimental Coronavirus Infection of Man," end quote. This was 15 volunteers. Remember, it's 1990s, bear with me here. And they took these 15 volunteers and they inoculated them with coronavirus. Not a bunch of it, but enough of it that you should have gotten coronavirus. Of those 15, 10 people did end up getting infected. And when they looked at the IgG antibodies, so the antibodies that should protect you long-term at 0.3 weeks, 0.12 weeks, and 52 weeks, there was a significant finding. Remember, at 0.0, that's before you are inoculated with the coronavirus. So this is just your baseline antibodies that are hanging around in the background of your system. And the log of that, because it's a log of 10, but we're just going to use straight numbers here, was 3.0. And then at 3 weeks, subjects had antibodies up around 4. But then at 12 weeks, the numbers were around 3.6, and when you went to 1 year, those antibodies were down to 3.3. 3.3 at 1 year, but remember, the baseline was 3.0, so can you even really say that statistically there's a difference between 3.3 and 3.0? I would say probably not. And I'll be honest, in this paper, it wasn't the best written paper, as 1990s evidence-based papers usually are not. They don't actually give us the real numbers, but they give us the charts. So I had to infer or guess on what the numbers actually were based on the chart and just kind of draw it across. It looks like those are roughly the numbers. Now, remember at the beginning of this, I said there was 15 people, they inoculated them with coronavirus, but only 10 people got infected. Well, when you look at the 5 people that did not get infected with this, of those individuals that were supposed to be inoculated with the coronavirus, but the coronavirus, for some reason, never took. Their immune system never caught on to it. They never got infected with the coronavirus, even though they were supposed to be. Their baseline antibodies was around 3.5. So those individuals that got infected at 1 year, their baseline antibodies were around 3.3. So maybe, just maybe, that is enough. 3.3 is pretty close to 3.5, but 3.3 is also pretty close to 3.0, which is the spot where they originally got infected. So which one is it? What do we do? What do we do? Well, the answer is you would inoculate these people again with coronavirus. But that would be completely unethical, right? That would be completely unethical. But that's exactly what they did, which is absolutely awesome. The papers aren't that well written in 1990s, but the way that they do their studies is awesome. So at 1 year, the 10 people that were previously infected with the coronavirus, they reinfected or they re-challenged with coronavirus. And this time, 9 out of the 10 patients that had previously been infected the first go around showed up to a lab. And these 9 patients were reinfected. And this time, 6 out of the 9 patients became reinfected. The good news is, during the initial challenge, the patients were shedding virus for 5 to 6 days. And during the re-challenge period, they were only shedding virus for 2 days. So the big take home here is, if you believe antibodies prevent infection, and we don't actually have data on that for SARS-CoV-19. But if you do believe that antibodies prevent infection, then maybe, just maybe, it works at 12 weeks. But we don't really know, since they didn't retest the individuals at 12 weeks. And we know for certain it didn't prevent infection or re-inoculation with the virus shedding at 52 weeks. Thus, if our current coronavirus acts anything like the other coronaviruses, its family member coronaviruses, if you will, then we are in a world of hurt. But let's get back to this original paper titled Projecting the Transmission Dynamics of SARS-CoV-2 Through the Post-Pandemic Period. One of their first assumptions is that, based on other coronaviruses, an outbreak can likely occur during any season, just like OC43 and HKU1, we will likely see outbreaks during the winter and spring, but that does not mean that they can't or won't occur during any other month. And I think that this makes total sense from what we have seen so far. I mean, just last week, it was snowing in the Midwest and it was 100 degrees in Florida, yet both of them had the coronavirus. I'm pretty sure last time I looked at a map that there was coronavirus absolutely everywhere except for Antarctica, and maybe because they don't even have the test for it yet, but absolutely everywhere. And North America, South America, Australia, Europe, we are all on or in different seasons currently, and we all have coronavirus. So to say, oh, don't worry, as soon as it gets hot outside, the virus will go away, is complete bull honky. There is probably no truth to that whatsoever. And if there is truth to that, then it was just a lucky guess, because there is no evidence-based supporting research that would make you say such nonsense. Another assumption that they made in this paper was that we can't social distance this away. Now, don't get me wrong, social distancing, or rather physical distancing, is a good thing, but here are the problems with it. Short durations of social distancing will work, but it just shifts the peak to further in the future. Long durations of higher intensity social distancing will effectively reduce the burden in the short term, but then again, we're going to eventually, longer only means that it just goes longer. So instead of a week or a month, we've now shifted that curve again into later in the year. No matter how long the physical distancing goes on for, you just push the curve later in the year. Now, there is permanent social distancing, which would work, except it would drive everyone mad, crazy, insane, or maybe all three. I mean, as you've already seen, we're all about a month into this, and no one wants to continue this. Everyone wants to be back outside. And all you have to do is go outside and look around, and people are dying for social interaction at this point in time. Now, the one thing that could work or may work is intermittent social distancing, which is when you look at the surveillance data of a certain area, and then that area goes into extreme social distancing. And then it relaxes, and then you wait till another hot spot or hot bed pops up, and then boom, that area goes into social distancing. And then you wait till another hot spot pops up, then boom, you wait for another hot spot, and then boom, social distancing. You get the trend. But that's what you would do. And that could work, that may work, but it's going to be very hard to get individuals in those hot spots to completely shut down for a week or two when the rest of the world, the rest of the country doesn't necessarily have to. But now that we have those predictions or those assumptions out of the way, let's get into some of the predictions. First of all, we don't know what the cross-reactivity of this virus is. Meaning if you get one modern common coronavirus, does it protect you from another virus from the same family? For example, in SARS-CoV-1 infection, if you had the SARS-CoV-1 infection, then the antibodies for that were generally protective against OC43. And if you had OC43, well, the antibodies for that were protective against SARS-CoV-1. However, we don't know if any antibodies are cross-protective with SARS-CoV-2. If there is mild cross-immunity between these common coronaviruses such as OC43 and SARS-CoV-2, well then we would likely see a huge decline in COVID-19 because your antibodies would protect you in the cross-reactivity against SARS-CoV-2. However, as we mentioned earlier in the paper, these normal antibodies for the normal common coronaviruses only last about a year. So we would see a huge downtrend in COVID-19 for about a year or two. And then once the antibodies wax and wane, we would see these spikes every 1 to 2 years when the antibodies are going down. And perhaps one of the most uncomfortable findings of this paper was that if immunity for the SARS-CoV-2, if the antibodies are not permanent, if the immunity is not permanent, and we can't develop a vaccine, then we are in deep trouble because SARS-CoV-2 will eventually enter into the regular circulation as a seasonal coronavirus and be with us forever. However, if the antibodies last a really long time, then SARS-CoV-1 and SARS-CoV-2 could disappear off the earth. And if there was really good cross immunity with the other normal coronaviruses, OC43 and HKU1, well then, if you had good cross-reactivity and immunity lasted a really long time, then all coronaviruses could disappear off the face of the earth forever. As I said earlier, we currently have no effective therapies for COVID-19, even though people are desperate for one. And that is no more clearly seen than in this paper in JAMA Internal Medicine titled Internet Searches for Unproven COVID-19 Therapies in the United States. What this paper did was they looked at Google and they looked at the search words that contained buy, order, Amazon, eBay, or Walmart in some sort of combination with hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine. Now, before I get into this paper, you all know that in order to buy or order hydroxychloroquine or chloroquine from Amazon, eBay, or Walmart, that means that you do believe, that you truly believe that the medication works. And it only works if you read the press and don't actually read the articles. So when they looked at the searches on Google, one of the most popular search engines that we have, on February 1st, they were looking at around, 1,000 times that combination was searched per 10 million searches. But then as you looked at March 16th, now we're at 3,800 searches per 10 million. And then as you looked at March 22nd, after the president comes out and Elon Musk comes out and says, look at this, we're going to do hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine. We're having really promising results here. Well, then there's 17,000 searches per 10 million. Remember, at baseline, we were only at 1,000. Now we're up to 17,000. And then at March 29th, maybe once people realize that it wasn't the dream drug after all, or maybe after they did a little of their own research, that number dropped down to 5,000 per 10 million. This is impressive. It's impressive because one individual can go ahead and spark 17 times more internet searches on one particular finding, one particular drug. And I think that it goes to show that people will do anything or will believe anything if it comes from the right source, which is a lesson that I hope that we had all learned not to do after World War II. But I digress. So if we have no treatment, well, then it's obvious that we need a vaccine. However, there are multiple papers out there that when testing vaccines for SARS-1 and MERS in animal models, scientists ran into antibody-dependent enhancement, which basically means that they gave the vaccine to an animal and then part of the vaccine in the virus that was supposed to be dead or killed or maybe using a live one somehow worked its way into the cell, took over the cell, and then infected the animal with that virus. And no one exactly knows the mechanism on how this happens. All we know is you give the vaccine and the animal gets the virus. Bada boom, bada bing, they get the disease, they get the illness. It's no good for anyone. And there are also studies out there that show a change in lung tissue, but no change in animal symptoms. The question is, what does this change in the lung tissue actually mean? Does it end up leading to lung pathology or lung disease? It is not only making a vaccine, but then testing a vaccine that is a long and time-consuming process. No matter how fast you want it to happen, you need to take the time to do it the right way, which during a pandemic, we all feel like we don't have any time, which has clearly been seen in trials that are being published in the New England Journal of Medicine that have no sample size, no endpoints, no control groups, no blinding, just a spew of vomit onto a piece of paper, and then bam, it's published in the New England Journal of Medicine, one of the top journals that you can get your paper published in. It's done. Not because it's a good study, but because we all feel like we're in a rush and we have no time and we need to get our information out there, even if it's bad information. But in this paper titled Human Challenge Studies to Accelerate Corona Vaccine Licensure, they bring up an interesting topic or an interesting point that I'm going to leave you with in hopes that you will use this to talk tomorrow with friends around the water cooler about what would you do? Should we do this? I don't know. You see, they acknowledge that getting a vaccine will take 12 to 18 months. However, a majority of this time is spent in the phase 3 clinical trial. Now, as a reminder, phase 1, the individuals are looking for safety and to come up with a dose. It's usually around 20 to 80 people. Phase 2 tests the effectiveness on a small population. And then phase 3 confirms the effectiveness and monitors for side effects in a large group. A large group meaning somewhere between 1,000 to 8,000 to 10,000 to 15,000 people. In phase 3, you are looking to find a difference in the rates of disease between the vaccine group and the control group. Instead, the authors in this paper propose in the setting of a pandemic, we perform challenge studies. Listen to this. Listen to what a challenge study is, because I wasn't quite sure and I had to dig into it. But here's what they would do. They would take previously uninfected individuals at relatively low risk of complications or mortality from SARS-CoV-2 infection and randomly assign them to either a vaccine or a placebo. These volunteers would then intentionally be exposed to the virus. The participants then would be followed in isolation for a set period of time to monitor whether the vaccine actually did its job or not. And while you were in this isolation, while you were under this study, if you actually did get sick with coronavirus, well, then you would have first-line therapy. You would jump to the top of the line for research, a ventilator, any medication that we have with us. You would get it all. It would just be for the benefit of science. And if this human challenge showed a promising vaccine to be very effective compared to placebo, well, then they would expand that study to involve at least 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 or more at-risk individuals, those individuals that are elderly or in a nursing home or have serious comorbid conditions. The benefit is that in these challenge studies, it takes way less participants over a shorter period of time because you are intentionally exposing people to the virus. And you would first do it in healthy people. If it worked in healthy people, you would do it in individuals at risk. We could cut the time to vaccine from 18 months to maybe only 6 months. The problem is the ethical issue that surrounds it. You are giving a potential deadly toxin to individuals for which we currently have no evidence-based effective treatment or therapy. There would be individuals in this that would die. However, they would do it for the greater good of the world. So the question is, if they call on you to be in the study, would you do it? And if so, how much? Or if not, how much would it take for you to do it? It's an interesting conversation starter that I hope that you all have with your colleagues tomorrow at work. And with that, I will end this podcast. As with all the coronavirus podcasts, I ask you, if you have learned one thing, if you took away one thing from this podcast, please send it on to a friend, to a family member, to anyone working in the front lines. We're all in this together. We're all scared. We all want to do what's right. We all want to do what's best for the patient in front of us. So I'll end this podcast as I have ended every podcast before it. Until next time, Keith Quest and Questioning.